Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back. It's Thursday. It's 4 o'clock. I'm in Brooklyn. This must be Mike Colomeco's Food Talk from HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Lo-fi radio here from a recycled 20-foot container that's contiguous to a restaurant dining room with a wood stove. That's how we roll out here. Yep, that's it. That's how it works. I got a wild pig's head hanging on the wall and some old furniture from somebody's college room. It's a cool studio. You got to love it. You got to love this thing. Oh, and part of the Colomeco package, the custom negotiated package through my various agents, is the pizza. I get a free pizza each show, which many times I don't avail myself of. But today I arrived having realized I had nothing to eat all day long, and I swam a gnarly swim with one of my mates at the athletic club in Manhattan, and I was hungry. So, yeah, I just had a half a pizza. So if I snore or fall asleep in the middle of the show, that won't happen. Anyway, welcome. It's a new, you know the show. We've been doing this now for, I think this might be over a month, for crying out loud. Yeah, every week it's a new record. Just got back from a really great little event, kind of somber, but great. People were celebrating. It was a Lou Reed Memorial in Lincoln Center outdoors. It was a 3 hours of no speeches, no none of that stuff, just playing Lou's music. It had been arranged by one of Lou's longtime producers and really good friend and confidant. An old friend of mine, mutual friend, Hal Wilner. Hal and I grew up together in suburban Philadelphia. Way back in the day, man, went to elementary school, junior high, and high school together. We were sort of punk kids listening to crazy music even back then. Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart and John Coltrane and Steely Dan, all the stuff that most kids weren't listening to then. And Hal went on to a great career as a music producer. He's sort of the producer's producer in the record business. His day job is he does all the sound effects for Saturday Night Live, a gig he has had for, I'm thinking it's got to be over 30 years now. Yeah, he's been there like forever. That allows him to produce records on the side, and he's just done some great stuff. Won a Grammy with Bill Frisell. But anyway, this wasn't about Hal. This was about Lou, and lots of people were there. It was just great to see. And, you know, hear about, hey, he spent a lot of time with Lou in the last couple of days playing music, playing records for him and talking and just hanging out. So anyway, shout out to Laurie Anderson. She seemed at peace with herself. She seemed like she was in great spirits. But Lou was a giant. He'll be missed. He was really, I don't know if you out there, I'm really into music. Is that a surprise to anybody? If you ever listened to my old show, it's probably half what I talked about was music and guitars and concerts I went to. But Lou was one of those really seminal figures in rock and roll that just influenced everybody. He was like Miles was to jazz, or maybe John Lennon. He was huge. I mean, you don't realize that he influenced everybody from punk to glam to alt to everything. Lou was just an inspiration, lived it on his terms. And from what I hear, he actually died real peacefully, and he was with Laurie, and he passed, and went outside and took his last breaths and walked around and did a little Tai Chi and said goodbye. So anyway, that was a great moment. So biked down from Lincoln Center to 14th Street, hopped on the L train, and here we are. We got a good show coming up. I'm jammed packed with guests today, which isn't going to give me time to talk about a bunch of stuff that I've been doing. Yesterday we filmed a show all day and night that was kind of celebrating the renaissance, the revival, let's put it that way, of French cuisine. You know, French cuisine in New York in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, that was all there was, really. New York was a French restaurant town. Any of you that know New York restaurant history would know that. It started with Le Pavillon after the World's Fair and the breakout of World War II, which stranded some great French chefs in this country, hence the Pavillon opened up, and then from that you had Le Caravelle, La Côte Basque, Le Grand Oui, all those Le La restaurants, Le Cine, Le Silk, all of them sort of came out of that tree. And that's kind of what ruled the city. And then in the last, as the century turned into this one, you know, 2000, 2001, Italian food just blew up. And everyone was just reading the obituary for French cuisine as all those restaurants closed. The Côte Basque closed, Caravelle closed, Lutèce closed, done, gone. But now there's a whole new generation of young, actually American kids just embracing classic French food. And I'm not talking about Andrew Carmellini necessarily, although he opened Lafayette to much acclaim and fanfare. And deservedly so. He's a big chef in the city. But right around the corner from him, though, it's a great restaurant on Bond Street called Le Philosophe that is super cool, insanely good wine list, absolutely great classic French bistro food. And around the corner from that, on the corner of 3rd Avenue and 4th Street, maybe it's 2nd, I get confused easily, Calliope, just Google it. Husband and wife team, Eric and Jennifer, they're great. They're in there all the time, breakfast, well, not breakfast anymore, lunch, dinner, and brunch on the weekends, but both in the kitchen, husband, wife, it's just great French food, so we did a piece with them yesterday. It was lots and lots of fun, so I want to celebrate what they're doing. But let me get to my guest. She's on the phone. I know she's been waiting patiently in the wings from Blustery, Vermont, one of the great baking instructors and educators here in America, Susan Reed of... Drumroll, King Arthur Flour. Hey, Susan, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Susan. Sorry to have to listen to my 5-minute intro here, but it's what we do. How are you, kiddo?
I'm good. I just got back from Quebec, where I knocked the rust off some of my culinary French too. So.
Oh, doing demos?
No, actually, it was a little bit of a vacation. So.
Congratulations.
The level of the food up there is just really high all the way across the board.
Yeah, I've always thought so too. I think it's the French influence. They've always kind of had it down. I don't know what we said we were going to talk about, but you know how you and I are, like, we don't stick to the game plan normally. We like plan stuff.
No, not usually.
Yeah, we plan stuff by emails and then we make like a left-hand turn and just go like another direction. So here's what I want to do, because I'm sitting, talk to this audience, because this is the first time you've been on this show. So you're the in-house recipe. What's your title at King Arthur? I should know this too, but what is it?
I think I'm trying to change it because I do so many things that it's really hard to put one label on it. But basically, I'm a chef and a writer. So I write half the time and I cook the other half of the time. So I can taste something in my head and I can write you a recipe that will get you to that flavor that's in my head.
So
I have this baking magazine called The Baking Sheet.
Thank you. That's it. To that end, I have the most recent edition, number 6. There's some Latin numerals that I can't read. 10. Is that 14? Is that volume 14? Did I get that?
Probably,
I don't know.
Don't worry about it.
I think I have that. I think I could do like up to that part I could read because it's XX1V. I think that's 14. But anyway, it's the holiday 2013 issue, and it's killer. Every time I get these things, and this is true, I'm not much of a baker. Chefs tend to be kind of like improvisers, like blues players, like rock guys, and bakers tend to need that other half of the brain that's more like classical music, because it's just a different skill set. So I've always kind of leaned away from baking because the results when I bake aren't great. But when I get this, when I get the baking sheet, which is mailed to me, what is it, 6 times a year?
Yep.
And how do people get this thing? Let's give a shout out so I don't forget. How do people get the baking sheet? They get a hold of you guys?
Yeah, if you go to kingarthurflour.com and in the search box, just put the baking sheet, you'll come to this page where you'll see you can choose print editions of it, or if I'm looking at it right now on my iPad, I have an app, and if you're a current subscriber to the electronic version, you have access to every single issue that was ever printed, and that it's like 3,500 recipes.
It's a treasure trove, and you test these recipes. This is coming out of your kitchen. You're the one that bangs these things out.
Yep.
Yeah, that's why I have you on. That's why I have you here on the line. So, can we just start? I know we didn't plan this, and you're going to say, "Why does he do this every time we do an interview?" If I could kick him in the shins, I would. But since you have it on your iPad in front of you, talk to me about Amish dinner rolls. I want to make these. It is a potato roll. Talk about this recipe.
It's a really classic soft tender roll. It's got some eggs and a little bit of sugar in it, some butter. And potato water if you've got it, and if you don't, it calls for mashed potatoes, so you're going to have potato water. And 4 cups of flour, and it makes a nice big fat recipe of tender, really moist the classic roll that you want that piece of leftover turkey and your cranberry sauce on the next day.
That's why I'm mentioning it. And then the potato rolls, like they sell, there's a burger roll. And I think when Danny Meyer went to do his Shake Shack, he actually used a potato roll because it is slightly sweet and it tends to be moist. And it literally has, this recipe calls for a 3/4 cup of potato water, which you're going to get because you're going to peel an Idaho potato or a potato of any type you want, I suppose. Yep. And you're going to simmer it in water till it's done. Strain it. You're going to mash that potato up, 1 cup worth of unseasoned mashed potatoes. And then you're going to use keep some of that residual potato water, 3/4 cup that goes in the recipe. Yeast fired. The thing sounds insanely good.
Yes, it is insanely good. I mean, they're one of those classic things that sometimes you see them shown with a little bit of flour dusted on the top, but we didn't shoot them that way in this particular one.
No, they look beautiful. They got a gorgeous golden color. They have another. There's a recipe that I've been playing around with for years because I'm kind of like my baking goes to like I can do cookies. I can do like the simple kind of dump, stir, don't over mix, wet kind of muffin-y things and cakes that resemble muffins. That's as far as I go. I'm really – yeast scares me, although you have yeast in this and I'm going to try the recipe. But you there's a carrot orange olive oil cake. Actually, when I make it, it's just orange and olive oil. That's great because what you've done here is you substituted – you're using olive oil as the fat, which you'll see a lot in Italy. Talk about this because these cakes, in my experience, these things are, A, really easy to make. They tend to be really successful, and they taste actually better like the second and third day. Like they improve with age up to a certain point, and they last a long time. Talk about this recipe.
It's a super moist thing, and this is an interesting year because of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving and Hanukkah are the same day, first time ever. So I wanted to find a recipe that sort of expressed the mitzvah at the same time that, you know, it made a nice dessert. And that's exactly what this does. So it's finely grated carrots. And the interesting thing about the recipe is the hole or the size that you grate the carrots is totally determines the texture of the cake. So if you've got a box grater and you've got those big holes on one side, you're going to get like a much chewier, probably drier cake. But what I am telling people to do is use that small little hole. It's
kind
not quite
kind
the
of shred them like a slaw kind of shred.
Yeah, and you're going to get all kinds of juice out of the carrots, but and that whole business goes right in the cake. And it's got some almond flour in it. It's really a yummy, yummy thing.
And what's the kind of icing thing on top? The frosting, I should say. It's really simple. It's just lemon juice
really
and confectioner's sugar.
That's all there is to it. Yeah.
And looks like microplaned orange zest or something.
Yes.
It's folks, you got it, this magazine's great. Can we talk about, because you have a tutorial online somewhere. This is the time of year. So Halloween's coming up. Hanukkah, Halloween, the same day. And then Christmas, we're whatever, a month later. So people are thinking about baking. And this is just, this whole radio station, Heritage Radio Network, is designed for, obviously, DIY, people that want to cook at home, because that's all we do. Every show around here is food. There's no politics, there's no cars, there's no nothing. So we're assuming if people are listening to this that they're into baking and cooking. Pie dough freaks people out. Do you still have that video posted up on the King Arthur website?
I do, yeah. If you go to our website and you type in traditional American pie crust, there is a video embedded of me doing the demonstration of how to make pie crust that I do on the road, which is a little bit unconventional, but it's extremely successful, and I've had people see me do this, go home, make a pie, and then bring it back for the second show later on, just because they get fired up.
You've done with me live on the PBS show that pie dough. I know you've done it. I think we've done a cooking class together, and you really do make it look easy, because I know, I don't know what it is that freaks people out. What is one of your secrets? Is it the size of the cut of the butter? Is it the temperature? How do you get the dough to work so well where you still have those kind of nubbly chunks of butter in it?
You want two different adjectives to happen in your pie dough. You want it to be tender and you want it to be flaky. So whatever fat you use, you work it into the flour in two different ways. The first half of the butter goes into the flour in pretty small pieces because the idea, what's that supposed to do, is coat the flour so that it doesn't get tough when the water gets into the recipe. The second half goes in these big monster chunks. I mean, way bigger than you, and there are some of them are the size of a quarter. And people always freak out when they see that. But that's what's going to make flakes in your pie dough. And just blind biked two pie crusts, and they were so poofy because it's almost like a croissant dough if you do it right.
Which is a laminated dough. Yeah, that's right, because I think you have the butter in two stages.
I do. So the second stage, you leave the butter in much bigger chunks. So you add the water, you stir it. And the problem that people run into is, A, if they're nervous about it, they overwork it.
Yeah.
And B, trying to get the right amount of water in is difficult because the sweet spot is really hard to hit.
And we tend and amateurs like me tend to add too much water and then start adding flour to compensate for the water, and we end up with this humongous, sticky, overworked mess.
Yeah, and at that, when you're starting to swing back and forth across where you should have stopped, then there's trouble. Yeah. So
we've all been there.
I work it in fairly dry, and then when it will barely kind of come together when you squeeze it, I dump the whole thing out on a big piece of parchment, and I sort of push it into a big line, a chorus line, and then I go get a spray bottle, and I just spray it to get it just moist enough to hold itself together. And then I take the parchment, and I use it to fold the dough over on itself like a business letter, and I just keep folding it, and I spray it once in a while, and I fold it again and again, and then eventually the dough will come together, and you haven't kneaded it, you haven't overworked it, and it's got a billion layers in it, and it's really tender.
So what you're doing, so that's why it's the croissant illusion, because it is a laminate. The fact that you're folding, that's exactly how that classic, I was watching somebody old school in a French restaurant yesterday making laminated dough with a huge, a rectangular slab of butter set before the flour, and I'm thinking, man, I haven't seen that in a long time. And that's how you work your pie dough.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't do the slab, but
of course, but that the idea is that folding. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
What's the website for it? So it's just kingarthurflour.com, and there's a huge recipe database there. Period. If people want to, they could subscribe to the baking sheet, which gets mailed four times a year. I'm telling you, I bake on a limited basis, but if I do 10 things well, 9 of them came from the baking sheet. That's a fact.
I am lucky in that. Once people know about the baking sheet and they sort of make friends with it, a lot of people find lifelong friend recipes in the baking sheet, which is really one of the neatest things I think it can do.
Oh, and by the way, it's about, I don't know, 20 pages thick, and it comes with 3 of those punch-out ring mold things, ring holes in it.
Yeah.
So you go to, like, your local Staples, and you buy a notebook, like, from school, and you can save these. And I'm not that organized. I haven't done that, but I swear, God is my witness, I probably have the last 20 issues of this. I know exactly where they are in my office, and they're all stacked up next to each other. And they're dog-eared, thumbed. Some of them are just turned to the recipe that I like. The thing works. We're going to get you back on a bunch because what King Arthur Flour does is great in terms of getting people to bake. You have a 1-800 number that's like a baking hotline that's free. People can call up and say, I'm freaking out, my meringue's not working, and get like a walkthrough. Is that still available?
Yes, I have to look it up real quick, but because that when people call up the hotline and the guys on the phone need an answer, they usually come to me. So I rarely call it. I'm usually on the other end trying to answer.
It's classic stuff. That's why we love you guys. I think that's why I met you guys years ago. Here you go. Give me the 800 number. So the
Baker's Hotline, 802-649-3717.
And we'll post that on the website from this particular episode of the show as well as the link to kingarthurflour.com and the baking sheet that's available. So as people go through the archive of the show in the description, they'll have all that stuff out there. Susan, I've got another guest on the phone, so I'm going to have to run. How's swimming going?
Swimming is awesome. We're about to do 50 swims on a minute 30 this Saturday.
Oh, that's right. You guys do that. Whatever the distance is, you can do on a minute and 30. So for me, I'd say 75.
Yeah, you would do more than I am, but yeah.
Yeah, I try. Today we were sprinting hundreds, but we were finishing at 128, 125, 130. But I need 30 seconds to recover. That feels like death after 5 or 6 of them. Hey,
yeah.
Susan Reed, great to see you. Happy Thanksgiving, Merry Christmas. Let's get on the date to talk again, maybe before Christmas or in January. And because I know you're busy, you're traveling the next 3 or 4 weeks.
No, I'm actually calmed down. I'm sort of back in the saddle. So
okay.
Good.
All right, good. We'll get you one more time. Thank you. My guest has been Susan Reed, kingarthurflour.com. She's great. Go to their website. Yeah, I know they help underwrite this in my PBS show, but you know why? Because it's probably the best flour company in America. When I went into the kitchens at Per Se and saw the kind of flour they were using, it was King Arthur's wholesale brand, ditto. Any bake shop that where they say money's not an issue, they're using King Arthur's wholesale flours. It's just a great, great product. Okay, I've got another guest on the line, Curry Coughlin. Curry, are you there?
I am.
Hey,
hello.
We've never met. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
And where are you in Seattle? Is that where we are?
Yes, I am based in Seattle. That's where our headquarters is for the Americas region.
Okay, so, and I should, if I'm going to do radio properly here, Curry Coughlin is, I don't have your title in front of me because I didn't write it down, but give me your title and then I'll fill in the rest.
I'm the regional director for the Americas region with the Marine Stewardship Council.
There we go. The Marine Stewardship Council, for those of you that don't know, came about in 1997, or plus or minus a year or so, and has become very popular really in the last half a decade or a decade. You'll see there a little, what's the blue thing? What's the symbol? It just says MSC?
It's a blue eco-label that says Certified Sustainable Seafood and has MSC on there as well. That's our acronym.
Okay, so back it up. I just have one quick question. We're going to take a, we have about 8 minutes. You and I are going to take a break, but we're going to stay together. And after the break at the bottom, we're going to continue this discussion well into the next half an hour, towards the top of the hour. But talk to me about, first of all, about your background and what led you to your work with the Marine Stewardship Council.
Well, it's been a circuitous route to my current position as regional director. I am a law school dropout, and I had a great career in journalism after going back to graduate school in journalism, and moved after a number of years from journalism. I decided I wanted to go to sea. I got a bug. And so I went back to vocational school, and I got my merchant marine license and seaman's papers and became a navigator and watch officer on a big ship going up to Alaska from Seattle, and spent some time up there doing that, and then became a fish buyer and did some at-sea trading with the big Japanese-Korean ships. I oversaw our roe production for some time. And then spent the following year and a half, really, again, being a navigator watch officer on a ship, but that was going through the South Pacific and worked on a five-part documentary for Spanish television. So returned from that and ended up with a career not so much back in journalism, but in project management, public affairs, and eventually corporate leadership until the governor of the Washington State appointed me to be the communications director for the state. I did that, went to the University of Washington after that for a little bit, and that was the juncture where I was looking for a global organization that was working together with business and industry to bring about change, either environmental or global health and development. And that's how I found my way to the Marine Stewardship Council, where I oversee North America, Latin America, and the Russian Far East for our sustainable seafood program.
All right. This is a huge challenge. So it's almost hard to, this is such a big ball, it's hard to figure out where to even attack it. So the Marine Stewardship Council, which I'm seeming to be having trouble saying, Marine Stewardship Council, there we go, I got it right once. Founded 97.
We can go right to MSC.
Yeah, let's go to MSC. Thank you. I can do that. MSC was founded in 97. It's headquartered in England. Is that correct?
Our main global headquarters, yes, is in London.
In London. Gotcha. And you're working with commercial fisheries to quantify species management. Is that it? Is that a correct assessment?
No. We very carefully are not fishery managers. What the MSC is essentially a standard setter. So we have developed, not by ourselves, but with the help of literally hundreds of scientists around the world, we have developed a standard, scientific standard, and a methodology for assessing to that standard to determine the sustainability of wild capture fisheries.
Would the term audit be appropriate?
It is, actually. Fisheries that want to enter the program do so voluntarily. There's nothing mandatory. And when they do that, they enter into a process with an independent third-party accredited auditor, to use your word. And they put together a scientific team that scores that fishery on 31 different scientific indicators around the health of the stock, the impact of the fishing on the marine ecosystem, and around the management. Is there a responsible management in place with the capability to ensure continuing sustainability of that fishery?
Yeah, I think audit's the word. back in the day, in between chefing and food media, I was an import agent for a while and was helped and worked with some big companies to do plant audits around the world. Because if you wanted to sell big importers, you had to meet a certain standard. So it's different, but it's not so different. A couple of great success stories, and one of them that I always like to talk about because it's a great American story, is the West Coast albacore tuna fisheries, where you had really a small group of families. This is all over the place, but down in San Diego was one of them that had been line catching albacore tuna for generations, freezing it, selling it to Europe, where it would eventually make its way back to here as canned or jarred albacore tuna at a premium price. And at some point, they began to think, if we just could invest and set up a line and can it ourselves, we could have this great American tuna that's relatively low in mercury, that's all line caught, there's no bycatch, it's sustainable, win, 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 and they've done that. And if I'm not mistaken, part of what the MSC has done, and albacore is a good example, is by those cans of tuna or those products being able to have your label on them, they can get a price premium. Is that correct?
They, in some cases, get price premiums, but what happened for that fishery, which is the American Albacore Fishing Association, or AFA, we call it, when they got their Marine Stewardship Council certification, one of the key things that happened for them was new markets opened up. The marketing director for that fishery, who's essentially the head of the fishery association, told me every fall when the boats came back, the whole job was about marketing, 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 selling fish, had to get on the phone, had to become essentially a salesperson. And as soon as they got their MSC certification, they had to, issue numbers. We can't fill all these orders. Their phone rang. They had to do no selling at all, just try to meet the orders. So they got that market boost. They also were able to do something very critical for their fishery, which is set dock prices with the processors before the boats went out. So they weren't bobbing just offshore with a boatload of fish.
You're
and
right.
Essentially victim to whatever the dock, processor said, well, I'll give you this much. Well, what could they do, at that point? So very much helped stabilize prices. And then, yes, with many of their contracts, their buyers globally were willing to pay a price premium for that fish because it was MSC certified.
And one of, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, because I, besides producing the show, I do a million other things, so I wish I had five assistants that could vet everything that comes out of my mouth, but I don't. I am the only one.
All need that.
Wasn't one of your first big clients in the country that either came to you or you came to them or somehow you guys met a huge food retailer in Walmart?
Exactly. Our program not only works with fisheries, but the idea is it's a market motivating program. So a lot of the fisheries want to come into the program because the big buyers have made a commitment to use it as a platform in their seafood sourcing. So in 2006, Walmart, which as you acknowledge is the largest retailer in the world, stepped forward and said, in 5 years, all of our seafood that we source will need to be MSC certified to this leading global standard for sustainability. And the program is not meant to be punitive, so these fisheries were given time, because it takes time. They may have to do things to meet the standard and go through the audit and go through the process. So it motivated fisheries around the world, even those that may not have been at that time selling to Walmart, recognizing Walmart was really a bellwether. This is what the market was going to be doing. And Walmart, in fact, was a big leader. And others followed. And now I would say almost all the major retailers recognize the need to do this. And it's really become, you mentioned, that you did plant audits and various things. If you wanted to sell, you needed to have certain certifications. Well, it's the same thing now as sustainability. If you want to sell seafood, which is the largest traded food commodity in the world, you're going to need to have independent third-party proof of sustainability in many, many cases.
You're working.
Walmart really led the way with that.
You're working closely, I'm assuming, with Whole Foods as well?
We absolutely do. Whole Foods was another retailer that was a pioneer in this. And we work throughout the entire supply chain. We just announced yesterday, or we didn't, but we work with a company called Highliner Foods, a very large processor of finished, what we call value-added products, the kind that you can take home and put in your freezer and pull out and heat up. And they just did a big announcement with a big school district in New York to highlight and promote sustainability. So I want to emphasize that we work with partners all along the supply chain. So from the fisheries themselves and the fishery managers, which we're not, are engaged, and all the way up through the supply chain to companies you won't have heard of and almost all of the companies that you have heard of on the retail and food service side are engaged.
When you make the distinction you're not a fisheries manager. I can assume that normally that job is relegated to whomever the flag on the boat or government responsible for those waters would be.
It is generally government.
Right. Right.
There are rare cases around where there are different types of associations or commissions, but in general, it's usually governments.
All right,
are the fishery managers, and they're a big, big part of ensuring sustainability by doing scientific studies of the stock and knowing factually how to set the quotas so the stock can be fished and provide the livelihoods and food security we need. But also know that it's replenishing for future generations.
Assuming they are willing to step up to that, as you and I know, there's a fair amount of fishing boats out there with flags from countries I won't mention that really don't give two hoots.
There are, and we call that IUU. That's illegal, unregulated, unreported.
Yeah.
And they're literally pirate fishing, and that is a problem worldwide.
Yeah.
But again, with fisheries coming into the Marine Stewardship Council program, they get the market benefits. Suddenly those fisheries not only are motivated to not engage in IUU fishing themselves because they'll lose certification, but they're now motivated to become activists to ensure that others from their country are not doing that as well.
All right, we're going to segue. We're going to take a break, but to keep people listening, one of the great success stories, and it relates to exactly what we were just talking about, is the Patagonian toothfish, a.k.a., what do they call it? It's Chilean sea bass, that was absolutely depleted. The biomass was shrinking down to nothing over a decade ago. And that, to my surprise in doing research for this particular interview, has been turned around. In a big part, you were part of that, but we'll hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break here at the bottom of the hour to give our sponsors a shout out, and we'll be back after that with more of Curry Coughlin from the Marine Stewardship Council and I talking about fisheries management, for want of a better term.
No more faces sitting here to fry, no replacement.
You are listening to Kill Me in the Summertime by Dead Stars on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more Food Talk with Mike Colomeco.
Sun erases again everything I'm hoping for, but I don't need you in the summertime. You're gone.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. When I'm at home and I want to make a great tomato sauce, well, it starts with shopping, and I always go for Cento brand San Marzano tomatoes. Comes from a region just outside of Naples in the foothills of Mount Vesuvius, where there's this amazing volcanic soil, a super clean high water table that the Greeks were raving about eons ago. It's a special place with a special microclimate, and it's really a unique tomato. It's kind of long and banana-shaped with a real thin skin, heavy, thick flesh wall, and not many seeds. It's the perfect canning tomato. So come mid-August, when the season's perfect, that's when they slow down the production, slow down the farming, and can the Cento San Marzano tomatoes. It's harvested with complete sustainability, and it's the best tomatoes, everybody agrees, for tomato sauce. All of Cento's San Marzano tomatoes, from the seeds to the fields to the farms to the production facility, are certified by an independent agency which guarantees the traceability. It's what I use when I want to make great tomato sauce at home. Cento San Marzano tomatoes.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Mike Colomeco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters. And I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about. But a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet, pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
Hey, folks, welcome back. You're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about a subject that's kind of near and dear to me. My guest is Curry Coughlin. She is with the Marine Stewardship Council, MSC. We're going to go back to the fallback position here. Heads up the American Division and has kind of spent the last bunch of years in her life devoted to this. Out at sea a lot. It's the kind of lifestyle you can fall in love with. I live in Manhattan, and I also live in Cape May, New Jersey. I've been kind of by city for the last, well, since 1987, so you do the math, quite some time. And Cape May, for those of you that don't know, besides being a great historical seashore resort and a lovely beach town and full of bed and breakfasts and gorgeous architecture and tree-lined streets, is also, depending on the year, the second or third largest commercial fisheries on the East Coast. We have a lot of commercial boats that go out. When I had my restaurant, I used to buy directly from the fishermen all the time, and many of them became lifelong friends. So I know there's always been this tension between commercial fisheries and any kind of oversight. They feel that they're out on the boats, they know the water, they know what they're doing. Who's this, you know, what are you telling me? So I know there's tension. We'll get to that a little bit later, but talk if we can, because we sort of teased on this before, about the success story that you guys really kind of helped orchestrate with the overfishing and the biomass depletion of Chilean sea bass.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, consuming seafood is something more and more people are doing in the United States. We know the health benefits of it. But it's very difficult. Fishery science and fishery management is so complex, it's extremely difficult for a consumer to know whether a stock they're buying fish that is being depleted or not. So we do that work for them. And one of the campaigns that was run around fish to help consumers a few years ago was Chilean sea bass. Its name is actually Patagonian toothfish, but that's not doesn't sound too nice on the market shelf. So its marketing name was Chilean sea bass, but it's not just from Chile. It's from all over the Southern Hemisphere. And it's a slow-growing fish. It's harvested usually around 30 years, so not a lot of room there in stock management for errors. And what the conservation organizations found was it was being terribly managed, really, worldwide, and overfishing, a lot of illegal fishing going on. And so they had a campaign, Give Bass a Pass, and to get people to take it off menus and off supermarket shelves. And that was effective. Well, that was about the time the Marine Stewardship Council was really gaining traction as the world's leading certification for sustainability. So a small fishery, South Georgia Island, the very southern Atlantic Ocean, down near Antarctica, came forward and said, we want to get certified to the Marine Stewardship Council. And the assessor that they chose went and took a look at the fishery and said, well, no, you're rightly painted with this brush. You have all these problems. They said, well, we'll fix them. So this fishery made changes in their gear and made changes in their data collection. They put observers, 100% observers, on the vessels to manage and track data to ensure nothing illegal. They made a gear change that reduced their seabird bycatch from tens of thousands a year to zero, and other environmental changes. They legitimately met the world's leading standard for sustainability. And Whole Foods Market immediately said, we'll bring your fish back and we'll put a little sign in the ice and tell people why this one fishery is okay. And they got back into not only Whole Foods then, but other markets. So, of course, what do you think happened? The next Chilean sea bass fishery nearby looked at this and said, hey, wait a minute, we want to do that. So you fast forward now to 4 years later, 60% of the world's commercially harvested toothfish is engaged in the MSC program. That means they are either meeting now or very close to meeting the world's leading standard for sustainability. Now, I would defy, you know, any kind of advocacy program or fishery management or regulation to turn a worldwide species around like that and get to 60% sustainability within just a few years. It's a remarkable story. And now consumers can enjoy, it's a lovely fish, and they can enjoy that and know that they are not contributing to the depletion of that stock at all.
Yeah, it's a really fast turnaround, and I was not aware of it either. That's what I kind of want to make my listeners aware, because I have misstated, not on this program, but actually in some of the public events I do, that it's a fish that I don't eat because it's been overfished. This happens a lot with fisheries, unless we're constantly updating our databases, I suppose. I know the Atlantic scallop beds up here, because a lot of the scallops that are caught in the Atlantic Ocean are caught between Virginia and, say, New Bedford, Gloucester, by bottom dredging boats. And I know that they watch those scallop beds deplete over the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And this was a rare case where the U.S. government, worked directly with the fishermen to figure out what was going on. They figured out that they were harvesting smaller and smaller scallops that were breeding age, and by changing the size of the mesh of the drags that they dropped off the back of the boat, and closing down some beds, but all of the above, they've been able to restore and maintain about 50 million pounds of harvest a year on beds now that are thriving. So, this can work.
It absolutely can. And that's a good example of how good, responsible fishery management can turn a fishery around. And the scallop fishery is actually the most valuable fishery, the Atlantic scallop fishery in the U.S., and they are in the final stages of becoming MSC certified. They're in the final assessment.
Yeah, it's good. And this bad news with the tsunami in Japan, it wiped out a lot of scallop beds in Asia, so I know a lot of scallop fishermen. I know kids that work on those boats that scallop, and the party's a little bit over, but for the last two or three years, scallop men and women have been really making a good living for change. I think it's the reason that New Bedford was the number one dock in America, for the first time beating the Alaskan fisheries in terms of dollar value catches in a year based on the price of scallops. Let's talk about something that kind of a dirty little secret, not so secretive, I suppose, because there have been exposés and things about it, but you talked about Americans eating more fish, and as a middle class emerges in countries like China and India and Brazil with huge populations, everybody wants to be part of this. Everybody wants to be eating fish, as opposed to their diet of, you know, beans and rice, whatever they were eating before. It's a good, clean protein. So we're seeing farm-raised doing a lot of work, and I know you have nothing to do with that. You don't work with farm-raised fish. That's not your reason to be. But we know that there's these huge factory boats out there, these ginormous processing vessels, and depending on how they catch, whether it's per seine net or whatever they're using, give me a worst-case example that I'm going to get to. This term bycatch, I don't think people realize that when you drop nets down, it can happen even if you're long-line fishing for, say, swordfish, and you pull in those long lines, and instead of having 65 swordfish, you've got 55 sharks and a couple of turtles. Talk about bycatch and what you're doing and how bad a problem it is, especially with those factory boats.
Well, it occurs in most fisheries, even if it's one person on, you know, their small little family boat dropping a lobster pot over. Almost any kind of fishing can result in bycatch, and that is we call it non-targeted species of fish getting caught in the gear. And it's addressed in our certification standard in our Principle 2 on ecosystems. So we recognize, our standard recognizes there will be bycatch, but there has to be what's considered an acceptable level. And that is not just a hunch. I think it's acceptable, therefore it is. It's been scientifically determined. by the scientists and conservation organizations, industry members who formed our standard and maintain it, that there's a certain amount that does not harm that unintended stock, or that we call incidental stock. And so there's going to be a certain amount of that. We encourage, it's not in our standard, but we would certainly encourage full utilization, not throwing things back into the ocean if they're dead, but using them where that's possible. But a certain amount is going to be allowed, and as I mentioned, the assessment teams, in going through the certification process for a fishery to become MSC certified, absolutely looks at that, and if that's too high, they won't be able to meet our standard.
I agreed, and I know that's what you're doing, but I've also heard from fishermen, from guys that make a living out there in the seas and have for a couple of generations, that some of these bigger boats, some of these factory boats, not necessarily American, they could be Russian, they could be from whatever flags they're hanging, the bycatch can be as high as 50% or more, and everything that isn't part of what they're getting gets tossed overboard dead. Does that happen?
Not an MSC-certified fishery.
No, not yours. I know that. I've read your protocol. No, I've read. I did a bunch of homework on you guys in the last 2 days. You're saying, I know. So when I had my restaurant, there were lobster pot fishermen in Cape May, and I would get totog that would swim into lobster pots. I would get monkfish that would swim into lobster pots. And it was just a bycatch that they could sell. They'd pull up the pot. They'd say, oh, there's no lobster. I've got a monkfish. I'll ice it down, and I'll sell it to a restaurant. I'm not in the monkfish business. But I'm talking about boats that have these ginormous purse seine nets that are going after, say, tuna. Drop that net down, pull that net up with literally tons and tons of fish in it, and it could be as high as 50% of that fish isn't tuna, it's going to die, or it's dead, and it just goes overboard.
Yeah, no, that certainly does happen. There's also a practice, and a lot of people don't think about this, there's a practice of what's now commonly called trash fishing, where, you know, large boats go out and literally do that. I mean, just take nets and scoop up whatever they get in their net. These are generally low value, not a lot of value for human consumption. But the reason there's a market for that fish is fish meal and fish oil.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Because, well, that gets to, we said we weren't going to talk about farm-raised fish, but I think that's one of fish meal and fish oil. But this idea, if you're farm-raising salmon somewhere, what are you feeding that salmon? What's in those pellets? So you're probably catching something, processing it, turning it into pellets, flying it halfway around the world, and dropping it into salmon pens.
That's right. It's fish feed, also fish oils that we consume as supplements. Yeah. There's the pet food market. So there's a lot out there, markets for fish meal and fish oil. You mentioned aquaculture, and the MSC program is a wild capture program, but we also partner with the Aquaculture Stewardship Council. And something I haven't touched on is not only certification of the fisheries, but MSC also operates a complete traceability program. So any claim that's made of MSC certification, anywhere that logo appears, that fish has to be able to be traced back through the supply chain to ensure there's no substitution, commingling, that it has come from the fishery of origin that it's claiming. And we now, Aquaculture Stewardship Council has partnered with us, and while they certify farming operations for sustainability, once that fish enters the supply chain, it comes through the MSC, what we call chain of custody, traceability program. So we do have a partnership in a certain way with aquaculture.
So your website is what? Because I'm always trying to direct people. I've been using blueocean.org, which is, I believe, the Monterey Bay Aquarium's website, because, again, a consumer wants to know, okay, I'm going to a market and I'm seeing fish A, B, C. I want to know, A, if it's sustainably, if the fisheries is being managed, am I doing the right thing? And perhaps for health reasons with some species, like, say, swordfish or tuna, or shark, I'm worried about mercury. I know blueocean.org does that, and I'm not going to ask for your opinion on them. I like them. Does your website have something similar for consumers?
Not quite. And one of the reasons, I mean, a little bit, but we are a fishery-by-fishery program. So Monterey Bay, Blue Ocean, and others serve a good purpose in that they can give perhaps some guidance. but there's no traceability component. It's not fishery specific, so we say, oh, shrimp from the southern Pacific Ocean, bad. Well, there might be some good fisheries in there, or an area that's good, there might be a bad one in there. Whereas with the Marine Stewardship Council, if you see the logo on there, it's been traced to a very specifically to a certain fishery, and it's traced all the way through the supply chain. So when you see the logo,
okay, I got you.
On a package, you see it in the fresh case, you can know that it's sustainable, and that's the distinction between the two programs.
Gotcha. No, I get it. The light just went on in my head. I get it. Okay, for talking about lower value fish, I used to fish a little bit as a you know, not sport, whatever. Put a clam on a hook, throw it in the water, and go for stripers here on the East Coast. And I'm an open water swimmer in the ocean, so all summer long I'll go out there a couple hundred yards and make a left or right hand turn with the currents and swim for a mile or so a day. And on clear days when I'm open water swimming. And I know when I was striper fishing, we have the bottom of our ocean throughout New Jersey is full of those little gray skate. They're just abundant everywhere. Real junk fish. You hate them. They're hard to get off the hooks and throw back. People don't eat them. I love eating skate. Is that a fish that you guys look at? Because here's kind of a low-value fish that Americans don't necessarily prize as consumers the way they maybe should. What do you think of skate, or you're not in the skate business?
I'm not aware of any skate fisheries that are in the program, but the MSC program is open for any fishery to voluntarily enter assessment, except fisheries that use poison and dynamite or engage exclusively in shark finning. Those are the only fisheries that can't.
Well, that's not fishing. That's something else.
Right.
All right, then let me ask you a fish that I know you deal with, and it's a question that I don't have the answer to, and perhaps before I ask you this question, I wish Americans as consumers would be more adventurous in the species that we eat. We certainly love tuna. We certainly love salmon, and we certainly love shrimp. Those are the three biggest fish that we eat. Beyond that, we seem to like cod, we like swordfish, we like those big fat fillets of boneless fish that are kind of easy to deal with. So let's talk about swordfish. Where are you with the swordfish fisheries? And if I can ask that question without... Is it too big a question, or when I ask about swordfish, should I be talking about the Canadian maritime versus the American maritime, East Coast, West Coast, globally? Talk about swordfish. Should we be eating it or not?
Well, there are swordfish fisheries that are certified, and you're right. There's one in Canada, and there's one in the U.S. Atlantic fishery. And there's a company called Dayboat Seafoods operating out of Florida on the U.S., swordfish fishery, and they really have done a remarkable job with implementing certain practices in order to get MSC certified, but that really make an environmental difference with that fishery. And so, you know, whether it's the circle hook, smaller hooks, fishing at a certain time of day to minimize any impact on turtles or bycatch, number of different things. And they do, it's a lovely fish, and they sell quite a bit of that. It's harvested swordfish is by either longline or harpoon. Harpoon swordfish is also certified to the MSC standard. It's a very environmentally responsible way to harvest swordfish. So consumers, especially on the east coast of Canada and the U.S., can eat swordfish from these certified fisheries knowing that this lovely fish that, as you say, we like to eat has been caught sustainably with minimum impact on the ecosystem.
The last one I want to talk about, because I want to have to break this off soon, and I don't want to, you know, give you no time to answer it. So American fisheries was really founded on cod. The Portuguese, the Spanish came to the coast of New Bedford and found more cod than they could shake a stick at hundreds of years ago. That was an okay relationship for a while until our ability to catch cod was better than their ability to reproduce in time. So we have seen up to 80 to 90% biomass reduction in the Atlantic cod fisheries in the last 50 years. Where are we with cod today? Because I know that Whole Foods was talking. I don't know if they did it or they didn't, because that's not where I buy my fish. But I know Whole Foods, there were a lot of cod fishermen who Whole Foods was their, they had exclusive deals to sell Whole Foods, and I think Whole Foods had worked out of the cod business. Where are we, not Pacific, but Atlantic cod, where are we with that fisheries right now?
Well, you've touched on something that's near and dear to us because it's really part of our founding. It was the collapse of the Grand Banks cod fishery that you refer to that was the inspiration to get the Marine Stewardship Council started. And out of industry, it was industry itself, said we cannot see this happen to the resources and form the Marine Stewardship Council. But that was exactly right. Cod tend to school together closely, so the fishermen really didn't realize they were pulling the last net of cod out, and the fishery had to completely close. 40,000 people were impacted in their livelihoods. That fishery now has been very, very carefully managed, and there's talk now of the stock rebuilding on enough to start a small, commercial, very carefully managed fishery. While the stock continues to rebuild.
There's also
Alaska cod,
yeah.
Which is MSC certified, and a very nice, similar whitefish.
You make the great point. So the cod fishermen, that's what, I mean, there have been a lot of boats that have just been docked and a lot of families that have gone out of the business. But so it is possible. I guess the best example to say, okay, so we've reduced the biomass by 85%. We're down to 15%. But if we manage that 15% responsibly, fish it responsibly, we can still eat cod. We're just not going to be able to fish it the way we used to in any way, shape, size, or form in terms of quantity, right?
You know, Mike, it's really interesting because if you think about fish and wild capture marine fish, it's the last protein source that we actually go out and hunt in the wild. And it's really a miraculous source of protein because all we have to do is not take too much and not destroy their environment. They will do all the rest. They will go out over the course of whatever their cycle is, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. They will go out, replenish, rebuild, and come, you know, back to their spawning grounds or come, you know, school again, and we can harvest them every year as long as we don't take too many and don't hurt their environment. They just keep regenerating.
Trouble is we've gotten really good at taking too many and looking the other way and hurting their environment. If you don't mind, I'd love to get you back on the show again in a couple of months if you make yourself available.
I'd be absolutely happy to.
Great, great conversation. My guest has been Curry Coughlin from the Marine Stewardship Council. They've got that little blue label that you'll see on seafood, certifying it has been that it is sustainable based on their audits. It's a pretty exacting protocol. More and more fisheries around the world are abiding to it. So it's been a pleasure speaking with her. Thanks for coming on Mike Kalameko's Food Talk. We've got a couple of minutes left. We'll just wind down the show here. Yeah, you know, commercial fishing is really near and dear. Fishermen are, I guess Curry fell in love with the whole fisheries thing by spending some time on the water. They really are unique. You know, there was a kid I knew in Cape May, McNulty was his name, and he went to Cape May High School, Lower Cape May Regional, and was thinking about going to college, and his dad was a captain. And he just thought, you know, college, I don't know, spend, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 on a degree. And, you know, these days, I don't know what those degrees are going to get you. A lot of college kids in and around New York and New Jersey and Boston and Philadelphia have no jobs. He thought, you know, I'd love it on the water. So straight out of high school, he got his captain's license. Young kid, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old, was a captain. And I remember his very first boat was just a little 50-foot center console scallop boat. And it was just him and one of his best buddies, and they would go out pretty much in all kinds of weather, but the weather was good, and I think their limit in New Jersey was scallop bags. When you harvest scallops, it's 50-pound bags, and I think it might have been 400 pounds a day. And they'd go out, literally cruise out at 7, 8 o'clock at night, get out to the scallop beds, harvest, come back in by 7, 8 o'clock in the morning or 6, 7 in the morning, and lump the fish across the dock. And you know, he just fell in love with that business of being your own man, of being out on a boat, of being out on the open water. There is this wonderful romance. It's, of course, probably the most, if not the most dangerous profession in the country. There was a year in Cape May when it was really horrible because it occurred right around Christmas and New Year's, where we had lost three clam boats, bing, 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 about a week apart. One of them was a brand new boat, like a $10 million boat that just went down. There was something wrong with the boat, the way it was built. It was back siphoning. Nobody knew it. We lost a bunch of fishermen. So I'm not going to romanticize what they do, but they really are the farmers of the sea. And I've got much, much respect for the people that spend their lives out there to bring us this seafood. But they're flinty. They're wonderful. They're independent types. And I think that's one of the other challenges of the people that are overseeing the fisheries is getting these sort of really independent type of people to say, fill out this paperwork or we're going to put somebody on your boat and go out and watch you. Well, you don't want to, you know, we don't want to do that. But they're going to have to do it. Everybody's on board, I think, more and more. If you're going to keep doing this and you want your children to do it, maybe the grandchildren, we're going to have to manage fisheries. All right, an hour's gone by. We'll see you next week. Sorry about last week. I told you I was going to do a ramen show this week, but I do that all the time. I make these kinds of silly mistakes. However, I can tell you, with 100% certainty that next week, if you're into ramen at all, I've got two great guests. George Cao coming in from Sun Noodle, which is probably the penultimate ramen manufacturer. They are like, they make like the Ferrari of ramen. They supply the best ramen shops in America with an incredibly artisanal noodle. George is going to be here to talk about what Sun Noodle does, their histories from Hawaii to L.A. to New Jersey now with their most recent plant. And then I've got Ivan coming. Ivan Orkin, one of the great ramen masters, an American kid, went to Japan, killed it in Japan with his ramen shop. He's opening up here in the Lower East Side any day now on Clinton Street in my neighborhood. So it's going to be Ramen 101, and I'm looking forward to that because it's great ramen is so good. It's genius when you think about this incredibly satisfying meal that you can get in and around New York, L.A., wherever, if you're lucky, of course, all over. I think there's 40,000 ramen shops in Japan. That this dinner, this completely wholesome, incredibly delicious dinner will set you back all of $12. I'm in. All right, so stay tuned next week for Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. It'll be Ramen 101 the whole hour. Thanks for listening today. Hope you learned a bit about seafood. Again, blueocean.org. You can watch that MSC label. You'll see it. We'll see you next week. Be well, folks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.